David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 322. I'm your host, Steve Raker, coming at you from the comic book bunker. This time around, we have a special Con Men episode, taking a look at some of the comic book shows and cons that we've attended in recent months. Marvel Noise is the podcast proudly sponsored by nobody, but we are graciously a part of the Deliberate Noise Network. We have a Facebook page and Twitter where you can offer us accolades or condemnations, depending on what's appropriate. I recently attended the Albany Comic Book Show in late October, just before Halloween 2018. The Albany Comic Book Show is local to me here in the Capital District area of upstate New York and is really an old-school one-day hotel banquet hall type comic book show, which is held three times a year in one form or another. The show is held in the naturally lit Holodome, great name, but natural lighting, which is great for the artists, with toy and comic and pop culture vendors taking up a little more than half the floor space nearby, and a sunken artist's alley loop area, this time around featuring, among others, Joe Sinnott, Ron Mars, Tom Rainey, Richard Clark, Mark Texeira, Sculptor Supreme Paul Harding, Jim Whitting, Raymond Lowell, and Keith Dallas. He's got the American Comic Book Chronicle hardcovers with Tomorrow's Publishing. And other local artists, too, are always, Paul Abrams and John Herbert and a couple other guys. Jolton Joe Sinnott turned 92 earlier that week, and a Fantastic Four cake was served while we all sang happy birthday to this man who's been kind enough to come up a few times a year and spend his Sundays with us here in Albany sketching. He's now officially retired from sketching, and rumor was it at this show that this might have been his last comic show appearance. Tom Rainey, he's always super nice to interact with. He hooked me up this time around with an extreme close-up of Thanos, like a big headshot, which I'd been casually after him for about a year for. Not that I had set it up and he'd made me wait, but just as far as looking for the right time to bug him. I'd seen him do something similar a few years back, where, all the line work and detail is on the periphery of the piece, and much of the center is just all negative space, yet it's so classically Thanos, I just had to have one like it. Ron Mars, man of many cons, and a pal of mine, is always fun to catch up with and hear about his travels, and since this show, he's been to some overseas shows, if I'm not mistaken. Other friends like Paul Harding had so many toys and statues on display that he's sculpted. So many that it was at times unclear whether he was even at his table behind them all or not. They were so towering. And Jinky Jim Whitting, who had three issues of his colorful Margot Intergalactic Trash Collector comic on display. Jim, he's become a good friend of mine, and he was kind enough to draw a wonderful Hela or Hela commission. Whichever way you like it. It's one of those words that I read for decades before ever heard being spoke. But he drew a wonderful Hela commission for me, which we had talked about actually over the summer after seeing him stalk a Hela cosplayer at another show and teasing him about it. And then we were sharing our love of Kirby designs. And I had suggested maybe it would be cool to scatter a couple of obvious Asgardian-type helmets at her feet or something like that. And Jim... he ran with it. He illustrated this lush background full of slain Asgardians with pikes sticking out of them and a big full-size cadaver of Thor still loosely gripping his hammer at Hela's feet. So cool. Jim recently ran a Kickstarter campaign that was a softcover artist edition style portfolio book that features his and four others' artists' work, called Dark Arts, at a nice 11 by 17 size. So look for that when it becomes available through other outlets. Even still might be available now post-campaign. I'll try to post a link to it in the show notes if I'm able to track it down. I also picked up an awesome Android sketch card, although I should say it was an awesome, awesome Android sketch card, and a Headless Horseman pen and ink piece from another buddy, Raymond Lowell, who always does nice work with all kinds of pop culture subjects. In fact, his kaiju of the day throughout the month of October was a real treat to keep checking in on. Lastly, the real treat of the show for me was Mark Texeira being here, who I'd had met several times before, and, I mean, he's both a real character and, obviously, a really talented artist with almost any medium. I mean, he paints in pencil, you know what I mean? And he's always fun to chat with. In fact, he's a bit of a chatty Cathy, meaning that even though I was first and possibly the only person on his sketch list for the show, he was so busy greeting fans and signing and remarking comics and stuff that he didn't get to my piece at all during the day. It was a Perez-era Starfire. I gave him a choice. At first I said, what about maybe a Deathlock? And his eyes bugged out, and he's like, yeah. And I said, or a Perez-era Starfire. And he's like, no, I've got to do that. So he was kind enough to say that he would do it after dinner at the hotel, right there where the con was. And when I spoke to him later in the evening after dinner, which a more realistic expectation, I guess, he said he would have it done the next day. He would do it before he left, and then I could come pick it up from him there at the hotel. And I didn't hear from him at all in the morning and shot him a couple of texts. And I was, Mark's a good guy. I knew I wasn't going to be left out of the loop, but I also didn't want to make it more difficult for him and have to be arranging shipping and all that sort of business. But at 12:15... on that next day, on Monday morning, because the show's a Sunday show, he texts me that it's done. And I make the 20-minute drive back out to the hotel, and there he is, waiting in the lobby with his luggage and stuff, and my piece. And we must have chatted for between a half hour and 45 minutes of all kinds of different subjects. Again, Mark is a great guy to talk to. He's got so many good stories and such a neat career and people's paths that he's crossed, etc. And he's such a genuinely nice, charismatic guy, too. It was really super cool of him to accommodate me in that way, and the piece was just fantastic. Again, one of the he painted with pencils. The next Albany show is usually around February-ish, and it's always a good time. Catch up with these folks, these creative people who have really become pals just because of the intimate setting of this Albany show. You know, like the old Mad Magazine roster, it's the usual gang of idiots, and I love them all. Come join us and check it out. You can get info regarding the next show at thealbanycomicshow.com. Next up on this year podcast, gentleman Jerry Arkell will join me to tell us about his one-day trip to this year's New York City Comic Con. Although I definitely take him off subject more than a few times onto tangential topics and things. And then we will wrap up with Andrew giving us the spiel on his trip to the 2018 8th Annual Kamikaze LA Comic Con, whatever they're calling it now, show. As promised, con man genial Gary Arkell is back on the show with me, having returned from the front lines to tell us about his adventures at the 2018 New York Comic Con. Welcome back, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
I was excited when you said that you were going to this show and were interested in telling us some of your tales, because this is a show that I used to love going to and enjoying hanging out with the EOC guys and stuff, but once my head became impaired, it just became too many moving parts and too expensive to keep up with the Joneses. So I've kind of cut back into, you know, some of the other shows that I do, like Baltimore. But I am always interested to hear about my pal's adventures there. So what kind of weekend did you have?
Well, I only had a Saturday pass. I mean, bought a couple of the passes in case I couldn't go Saturday, but I chose to use a Saturday because that was what worked best for me. And lots of times when I go Sunday, it's empty. Although Sunday's been pretty comparable to Saturday, where the last time I went on a Sunday. So I got there early, 10 o'clock. They let us in the door. And actually, I mainly stayed in Artist Alley, because that way you don't have to deal with the crowds in Diva's room. And
Absolutely.
it was pretty empty, like around 10 o'clock, because I think everybody went beelined over to the showroom and the dealer's room first. And that way the Artist Alley was empty.
What about the talent? Were they all were people there, or were people not there yet because of a happening Friday night? You know what I mean?
That there were some people who you think weren't there because they were sleeping in late, because the tables were empty, and their banners were still up, and their name tags were there, so I could
Sure.
see who was sitting wherever,
Yeah, sometimes that can affect, Artist Alley getting going on those Saturday mornings.
I know, and that's the funny thing is that's why I didn't like going on a Sunday, because everybody would be out drinking on Saturday, and then they wouldn't show up on Sunday,
Yeah, but now it's a 4-day show, so now you
I don't know if everybody shows up every day or not, So, I went and walked around, and I saw Giselle Lace. I don't know how to pronounce her last name.
The
She's the
glass.
one who does, yeah, she's the one who does that web comic, and she was doing Betty Boop for Dynamite, and I talked to her for a little bit. I did not see the 11 o'clock guys walking around at all during the whole day. So they must have been roaming around when I wasn't in their area, and I know how to recognize them now, but for some reason I didn't find
Those guys get to walk behind the curtains now,
them.
They're
Probably.
not out there with us schlups.
So, I roamed around for about 2 hours until the panel that I wanted to go. The one thing that was around 11 o'clock, I found where Chris Claremont was. And I was looking in my knapsack, and I was like, I don't have any comics with me that he wrote. So it's like, what do I give him to autograph? And I actually had a X-Men Grand Design that he didn't really write, but he did the original stories.
Sure. It's a
That.
love letter to his work, so.
Exactly. So I got online. The line was only maybe like 7 people long, which was very short. And I said, okay, I'm going to have to pay $10 for this, but I didn't mind. And I get up there, and I think his wife was helping him. And she looks at the comic strangely, and she goes, Chris, did you write this? And he goes, no, I didn't write this. And I said, well, you indirectly wrote this. And he starts looking through the pages and everything. And he acted like at first he never saw it before.
That's one thing I like about Claremont when he's on, and I know that there's stories about times where it seems like he might be having an off day attention-wise or whatever,
Right, right.
but when he's on, he really takes the time to look through the comic to look through the comic that you brought for him to sign with you and comment
Right.
on it. And that's kind of cool, because for the person who's not an autograph hound like myself, like who's not
Yeah.
trying to create merchandise to sell or flip or whatever, I do just pick out one or two comics that mean something to me, even if it's my, overly read copy. I don't care. It's the one that I had as a kid, and I want him to sign that one because that's my little memento of crossing his path, right? So then when he takes the time to flip through it and comment on the pages and laugh at certain sequences and stuff, Sergio Aragonés is like that too. You bring him a book and he starts flipping through it and he starts cracking up at his own jokes. And it's so darn entertaining that you kind of feel like you're back behind the table there with him and he's taking you through it.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want the guy to just sign the front cover and then just say, get away from me and give me your $10. So he actually opened the book up and acted like he didn't recognize it at first when I thought, he just did a panel with Jason and the artist, and
Oh,
I
Ed
was saying,
Piskor.
yeah, I said to him, I said, I thought you did a panel about, with Jason and Piskor about this. And at first, he acted like he did not remember that panel. So he started looking through the comic and he started like smiling and laughing about it to himself. And then he says to himself, I got to get a copy of this. And I said, you didn't get comped on this? And he was like, no, I don't get comps anymore. He goes, they don't remember me. So he turned it to the cover and he signed his name very nicely. And his wife was still laughing about it because she, of course, she didn't recognize it. But then again, I don't think she reads every comic that he writes. And now, it's something like he was saying to somebody before that he used to write science fiction novels, and that's why he put so much depth into his comic book stories because he came from the prose side. He was telling that to somebody. I've never come across any paperback, or science fiction novel that he wrote. So I'm gonna have to try to look through Amazon and as using him as an author.
When he was a young comic writer, though, in the 70s at Marvel, he did do like Star-Lord stories and things, and he did write some space stuff, so and took sure certainly took the X-Men there as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if he had a couple of up and coming type novels at the time.
I mean, I don't know if he moved from science fiction to comics or whether he was dabbling in science fiction while he was doing comics. I mean, because occasionally when I was reading, when Jerry Conway was doing DC, I would go to Doubleday, if somebody remembers Doubleday,
Sure.
and I would see a Jerry Conway paperback novel on the shelves, and I would buy it, and then later on, if I saw him at the con, I would show him that paperback, and he'd be like surprised that I would be buying paperbacks, so he would sign it for me.
Oh man, when my mother would drag me to the mall because she had to do something, I would always go to like the Walden Books or the B. Dalton Books in the mall and just scan those paperbacks looking for some Mad novels or some, Fumetti type things or the Star Trek stuff or the science fiction. Always looked for different covers and try to find the Frazetta stuff, some of the Robert E. Howard. I love doing that.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. I mean, back then, the cover is what caught your eye,
Sure.
and you bought a book based on the cover, or maybe you looked at the back cover and you read the little blurb. It's like nowadays when people buy books on Kindle, it's like almost like the cover, whatever little cover work they put on that little thing is wasted
Well, Gary,
because.
a paperback at a Doubleday paperback at the bookstore, even full cover price was maybe only $1 more than the typical comic book now. The 22-page comic book now. So, you could risk buying a few duds, just for the cover.
They were 75 cents those paperbacks when I was buying them. And I remember when I came across the Steranko History Comics,
That's great.
and I think that was $5 when I came across it. And I kept on bugging my father for $5, and he's like, "Oh, you normally ask me for just $1. Why are you asking me for $5 this time?" And I showed it to him what I wanted to buy, and he was like, "No, that's not for you." He wouldn't let me buy it like the first three or four times. I finally had to one day bring my own $5 and buy
But
that.
Steranko.
But.
So Steranko in Baltimore, we were hanging out at the table next to him and kept crossing his paths because he was at the show. Not that I went to any of his panels or anything. But it's so funny. I think he is slowly, as he ages, like he's shrinking, but his hair isn't, So it's like he's It's almost like he's retreating into his hair like a hermit crab into its shell, and I think someday there'll be nothing but, like, a little pile of ashes and the hair and the sunglasses, mm-hmm. and that's all that mm-hmm. will be left of Steranko.
So that's cool. He, I don't know if he was there this year. He might have been in the dealer's room, because I think the guys like him and Neil Adams go into the dealer's room because they tend to have more merchandise they want to sell.
Sure.
So they go in there and they think they get more volume that way.
Yeah, Neil Adams needs a lot of real estate, you know?
Yeah. From the last time I went and got a comic sign by Neil Adams, he had this huge table.
Exactly.
So, and all his books and stuff, he offered to sell. So.
All right, so what else at New York? How was the panel?
I got on land at the panel about a half an hour earlier than the time. The time was supposed to be like around 12:15, and I got there around 11:45. And I didn't mind like waiting there, because that way I know I'd be able to get in.
Sure.
And the panel was about, there was about 30 people there, I'd say at least. And when we got in there, it was just C.B. Sabolsky. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right. And he was just sitting there at the table. And he was going to be the only one speaking. And I think he mainly wanted to calm the waters and introduce himself and let everybody know that he wasn't like opposed to whatever Joe Q, wherever Joe Q was coming from and whatever Joe Q was doing. He was going to keep the same, similar stuff to what Joe Q did, keep what works and get rid of what didn't work.
And then okay. Axel Alonso after Joe Q too, right? So was this billed as a Marvel, like the Marvel panel, like the what's coming at Marvel? Or?
I think there was, no, because there were two other Marvel panels. There was one other one that they called the what big thing is coming next.
Sure.
And that was going to be at 4:30, which I think, is late in the afternoon. Then they had a Marvel panel that was for only Marvel Unlimited people, and that was 6:30.
Because this sounds like it's C.B. Sabolsky's version of, like, a cup of Joe, speaking of Quesada, Like,
yeah,
here's a little one-on-one with me.
It was a very casual, intimate type of thing where he talked about when he was a young kid, and he had this very funny story about his grandfather taking him to get a haircut, and he would always cry when he gets his haircut. So this time his grandfather took him into the little store, the newsstand next to the barbershop, and let him buy a comic book. And while he was getting his hair cut, he was so into reading the comic book, he didn't even notice the barber cutting his hair.
But then it was he noticed it was the issue where Gwen Stacy died, and then he cried anyway.
Unfortunately, he didn't get to that story.
Or is the first appearance of the Vision, and he gets to the last page with the tear. The Vision did
his
crying
for me. That's
probably
when his haircut got messed up. That's how he explained how his history of comics was. And he actually, like his parents, spent money for him to go to an art school. And then when they saw the results, they said, "Oh, we won't send you anymore to this art school," because he couldn't draw. And then he would send in scripts to Marvel, and then also scripts to different book editors, and they were constantly rejected. So he gave up on that, and he started to go to the cons more often, and he started to meet the creators and the writers, and he would bring the rejection letters with him to the cons, and he would casually say, "Oh, you rejected me," and make a joke out of it. And that way he got very friendly with them, and they actually introduced him to different editors. And he kept on saying, I want to join Marvel, I want to get to the company, but I can't drawer, and you seem to not like my writing. So he said, what else can I do? And they said, well, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that you could do, and you probably need to, you know, continue your high school and college. So go that route, and we'll call you if we have anything that, you know.
Yeah.
Don't call us.
We'll call you.
Well, the funny thing is that approach worked because he went to college and he got like a marketing degree and general business. And then later on, the people that he spoke to and kept in contact with all the time, they actually got him that job as being a talent scout.
That's cool.
So he actually did get into Marvel that way. So he said his parents were behind him 100%, which surprised me because, okay, maybe his parents were more modern than my parents were, but I didn't have that support as far as my hobby and then my wanting to write science fiction and different things like that when I would try to do it, you know, when I was young. So he had very modern parents.
Well, maybe they were just counting their blessings that he wasn't still trying to draw. Yeah.
That's
like,
true.
Well,
that's
at least he's not trying to draw because he can't draw.
Yeah. And he also said that they lived in Europe for a while, and he got exposed to a lot of European comics when he was living with them over there.
And that helps with his whole talent scout thing. And then right. as he's peppering the company and then ultimately the industry with talent that he helped find and cultivate. And then he's got friends all throughout the business at all different levels too. So it's a really grassroots kind of a way that he spread like a virus, you know?
Yeah. So the funny thing is he had to calm down a rumor when he was on the panel, and that I don't understand about. He claimed that he went to some con and John Byrne was there,
right.
And he just went up and talked to John Byrne and made friends with him. And all of a sudden, all these people were taking pictures of him with John Byrne and assuming that John Byrne was going to come back to Marvel.
Correct.
And he said that rumor is not exactly true, and don't start thinking that he's going to come back to Marvel and start doing this series or that series because, you know, we were just trying to make friends. And so that was it. But I do see now that they claim that Liefeld is going to do an X-Men series, which surprised me that he's coming back.
Hey,
so,
the first issue and a half will be great.
I know. Exactly. Well, we'd be lucky if we get 3 issues out of it.
That'll be Murat Michaels for a whole bunch of issues.
So we then he opened up the whole thing to questions and answers, and I really didn't like the way he did that because he, and I don't want to bring this on a downer, but a lot of the people got up there and they, some of them didn't have a question, but they really just wanted to get up there and talk. So it kind of like extended the panel to what you didn't want to hear, you know? So the people would get up there and they would ask about the whole thing about bringing new characters in and then keeping the old characters still around.
Sure.
And he realized that he agreed that putting the new characters in place of the old characters didn't quite work because the sales dropped drastically. And so he agrees that if they're going to bring new characters in, they're going to have them on their own separate little series and see if they survive on their own separate little comic, rather than replacing Tony Stark with somebody, you know, permanently. He thinks that it's best to have, you know, Ironheart borrow his equipment and then go off on her own little adventures and keep Tony in his own book.
Agreed.
So that, you know, that got like a lot of pushback when they had Captain America, who was not Captain America. They had Iron Man, who wasn't Iron Man. Who had Hulk, who wasn't Hulk.
Thor wasn't Thor.
Right, right. And then they didn't
There was no Fantastic Four.
Exactly, exactly.
There was so about five Spider-Mans.
Yeah, so they you know, the sales dropped then, and they, it didn't work. But they didn't want to admit it at first because they kept on saying, oh, we want to create new characters, but then when we create new characters, you know, the old fans don't like them.
You know, good old Daredevil for hanging in there and just being himself.
So, yeah, so then I kept on noticing there was this woman who was sitting in the other area, and she had purple hair.
Uh-oh. You got to watch out for those purple-haired girls.
I know.
Psylocke.
And she looked, yeah, and she looked like she was in her 50s or so. So she wasn't like, you know, your average girl you see, you know, with purple hair nowadays. So she actually got up on the line, and when it was her turn, she introduced herself as Catherine Grunwald, Mark's widow.
Neat.
And the reason why she had purple hair was because she was honoring Diamondback, who was Captain America's girlfriend at the time when Mark was writing the book.
Hilarious.
So
I love that character.
I know. So she, her question was, is as long as we're going to, Marvel's going to continue honoring the previous creators and writers, she was happy. So that CB, you know, said he remembered Mark and he was, you know, he loved Mark. So he said, you know, don't worry, we're going to continue remembering the people of the past. So,
yeah, Diamondback is in the Domino series right now as one of her, like, Scooby Gang supporting characters.
Yeah, yeah, I read the first comic. I didn't get to. I had the rest of them. I haven't got back to that series yet. So, I will. Then there were other people who got up there, and like I told you, they were rather long-winded, and they didn't. They just wanted to
filibuster.
Yeah, they didn't really have questions. That's the funny thing. So this one woman who I guess she had this idea of creating a lot of creator-own comics, and she a lot of her friends were telling her to go to Boom or go to Dark Horse or go to Image. And she's like, she said, why should I come to Marvel when I don't really see a creator-owned line in Marvel anymore? And he said, and CB said, the way the market is now, they'd rather keep their own universe and have everybody playing in the same sandbox. And they're not going to have a creator-owned line yet in the current market. So he says you can come over to Marvel and create your new characters, but they're going to be playing in our universe. And that's the way that we have it set up currently. So I don't know if she was happy with that or not. But he said one thing is we give you, if you do come to our company, we give you a character to support it needs as far as advertising and promotion and also side products if the character is doing well in his comic.
I mean, this could all go to, you know, their deal with their corporate overlords of Disney, you know what I mean?
Right.
That because certainly the Icon line or whatever it was called that they had going for Mark Miller and Brian Bendis and the likes, that faded pretty quickly after the... I mean, there was a few projects that were in the works that ended up coming out, but, I mean, Power stopped coming out. Everything sort of faded pretty quick after the Disney merger. And now we see DC has decided to fill that, you know, that vacuum. And now they have their little creator-owned thing going, I think, don't they?
Well, they've had Vertigo, and they've got it expanded now. I noticed that like when Bendis came over to DC,
yeah,
he has like three or four different
right
Vertigo comics that are coming out, and I was like really surprised. And I figured he must have had those in the works and sitting around, and Marvel wouldn't do it for him, So the minute he came over to DC, he was like, okay, here's one story, here's another story. And that one comic has bounced back and forth between three different publishers of his.
Yeah, well, I see Scarlet is coming back. Scarlet. Yeah.
That was in some other independent publisher first, and then he brought it over to Marvel, and then now it's over in DC. So it's that one, originally there was supposed to be like a TV series or a movie,
yeah,
and nothing ever happened to that.
Well, when you own it, it doesn't matter who publishes it. You're still the owner, so you can bring it around wherever you go. That's the deal. But I think Vertigo isn't exactly creator owned, if I'm not mistaken. So, they're making some sort of accommodation for Bendis. So, like I said, they're filling in that vacuum that Marvel had previously been able to do.
Right. I think DC gets to still create different like T-shirts or things, and they get the money from that. And the Vertigo creator only gets a portion of it. He doesn't like. Excuse me. He may still own the characters, but he doesn't get 100% of the money like the Image people do.
Like, but do you think Garth Ennis owns Preacher? I don't know. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just kind of putting that question out there, kind of a thing, you know? Certainly Gaiman doesn't own Sandman.
Right.
So it's, you know.
Well, he didn't originally, rebooted Sandman. He
right.
didn't originally create the Sandman. But as far as Preacher, I don't know. You know, it may depend on the contract that the creator drives, you know.
That's what I'm saying. Between Marvel's closing of shutting down the Icon thing and Bendis moving over to DC, it seems like they're making room for that sort of product there over at DC now, where previously it had been a Marvel thing. And DC wasn't able to find a way to get it done. You know what I mean?
Right.
Anyway, but go on. I pulled you on a tangent.
So, and then he, there were some other people who had different questions about the new Champions group and the Runaways and you know, he was just saying how he's trying to bring more younger characters in Marvel. And seeing which ones work and which ones don't work, you know. I mean, you see, like the young kid who's Nova, he's still in the Champions book, but his own book kind of got canceled. And that's, to me, I was liking his own book, but you know, some people still wanted the old Nova to be around. So,
well, now we have neither, right? So, what's up with that?
Well, he's. I noticed that they took away his helmet in the latest issue of Champions that
yeah,
I read.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going to happen after that. Like I said, I'm not recurring on all of the series, so I don't know if they'll have a issue where they'll have him throwing away his costume in a garbage can.
I mean, they still haven't resolved the whole his dad, his personal story still isn't done. And
right.
So I'm surprised that they didn't figure out a way to do that in his solo story somewhere or by now. It's been years, you know?
What they should do is have the I guess what I would do is have the whole Champions team go after his father and try to find his father. I mean,
and then Krakoa encaptures them and they have to go to the original Champions to come and save them.
That would be cool.
Hercules,
be cool.
Black Widow, the Ghost Rider, Iceman and Angel. Come on, Gary. Let's bring them back. Like the old Marvel Noise segment. Bring them back.
Yeah, that would be cool if they did that. Had a Champions crossover.
But, hey, they're bringing the old Defenders back. Why not?
Well, yeah, I saw that in the previews this month, and that looked pretty good. So we'll see if it works. I didn't know that they would do that when they gave the Defenders name to another team.
Right, for the TV stuff, you'd figure they wanted to really rebrand it to stick with the greater media market.
So, So after that panel ended, they gave us, on our way out, they gave us a Scotty Young variant of Iron Man 4. So, what was it, Monday or Tuesday, I went on eBay and I started looking for it, and it's worth about, the going price is like $99.
What?
So, because there are only 500 printed of this Scotty Young variant. So I was kind of surprised that they were giving it away. Now, I know at the Marvel Unlimited panel that was 6:30 that I didn't go to, they were giving away goodie bags. And that was only open to Marvel Unlimited members.
Ah.
So if I was able to go to that panel, I think it would have been better. So, and then a friend of mine who owns the LCS that I go to, he says he gets a whole huge goodie bag when he goes to his little...
the Retailer Summit?
Right. Well, he's getting a little... crazy because he says I have so much stuff sitting around my apartment and my store I don't know what to do with it. So,
yep.
So then I walked around the artist alley some more. I met the artist who's going to be doing Conan for Marvel.
Mahmoud Asar?
Yeah, and he had some preliminary drawings that he had up there that he was allowed to show. To me, they looked more impressive than some of the Dark Horse stuff that I was reading. And I said, how come it was on the cover of previews 1 month, and then there was no number one yet? And he said that they're not going to have a number one out until January of 2019. So even though they have it done, they don't want to do the promotion.
Well, it looks like they're doing the Star Wars Return to Marvel model and putting some high quality creators and production values into the book. So I say let them get ahead, because otherwise they're going to get behind and we're going to have problems. Conan was a standard staple that you could always count on because it was Buscema doing it. But, you know, we're going to have a bunch of different artists here, and I'm sure you're going to be able to trade off for the different arcs. Conan's perfect for that.
Yeah.
You know, my concern somewhat is the writing, but we've got Jason Aaron doing it, who did a great job adapting the Star Wars stuff also. So Conan is near and dear to my heart. It was one of my favorite comics. It's one of my favorite literary adventure fantasy type characters, and visually I just love heroic anatomy, and you don't get any more basic than a Conan or a Namor, you know. Just a big, hulking, heroic guy with great anatomy, you know. So, I can't wait. I can't wait for this.
And I don't... He doesn't think they're going to mix him with the Marvel Universe. So,
yeah, no.
He says that's not on the table. And I agree with that, because when I used to talk to people who corrected Conan, most of them that just solely corrected Conan and Cole and Red Sonja, and that was it. They may have gotten one or two Marvel heroes, but they didn't want the two of them to be crossing over.
But remember how charming that Marvel team-up was when Mary Jane got possessed by Red Sonja and they did the Spider-Man Red Sonja thing
I didn't read that.
That's Claremont Byrne. You got to read that. You go on Marvel Unlimited and find that. It's like around the
70s
or 80s.
Yeah. I might even have a copy because
that's good.
Last year I bought a long box and it had a lot of Marvel team-ups and Marvel 201s in there. So I have to see if I have that. Oh, I can read in a Marvel Unlimited.
And Conan only crossed over by doing those two what-ifs, you know? What if Conan was like a pimp and, you know, in the 20th century? And then the one where Thor and he crossed over, where Thor goes back and you know, they got to climb the mountain at the end and to find Krom. And Conan can only climb so high because he's human, and only Thor could keep going because he's a god. And he meets Krom, who, of course, is a very unforgiving, not very social type god.
Right. And the funny thing is, I kept on saying to him, are you submitting your artwork to the Howard Estate to get it reviewed? And he kept on like not knowing what I was talking about. So maybe Marvel is sending it to to the Howard Estate to get reviewed without him knowing?
Yeah, the editors. Or maybe the editors got to be doing taking care of all that and sending them, you know, the equivalent of the dailies. When the pages come in, they probably send it off to the estate. The script has already been okayed, you know, that kind of stuff.
Okay, then I guess it looks differently than with when I was talking to the different artists who work on G.I. Joe. They would actually send their work to the toy company, and then they would, you know, tell them change this or change that. So I guess it's different in Marvel, where it has to go through the editor first, and then the editor's sending it.
Yeah, well, back in the day, Roy Thomas, who was writing the bulk of the Conan stuff, he had a really good, you know, and he was editing it too, so he was able to facilitate that however it worked best for the process of getting the book out. But he had a really good relationship with Glenn, I'm spacing on his last name, who was the longtime
representative from Howard?
Yeah, of the estate. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So they pretty much had a... You knew it was all Roy, and you knew Roy had the best intentions and a good handle on the character, so you could give him some leeway. It might be different now that there's going to be different creators involved, because now there's going to be different voices, different interpretations, so you're going to have to get them all checked. I wonder if that plays into how they decide to distribute and assign the talent.
It sounds like he says they're going to be have like different 6-inch stories and sort of like mini series, but they're all going to be it's going to be an ongoing title, and he didn't think that they're going to have like launch 5 books all at once or something like that.
Right.
You know, obviously when they did Star Wars, there was a lot more characters that they could have different series with.
Now, if they could only bring Red Sonja back. Since they created Red Sonja, really?
Yeah, I'm kind of mixed about them having Red Sonja, because the thing that I'm afraid of is if the sales don't do well right off the bat, they'll cancel the comic, and then that will be it. You know,
yeah.
It's like when she's over Dynamite, they seem to granted they have like different series, and then they have an ongoing with her. But I think that Dynamite is happy with the numbers that she gets over in Dynamite. But the problem is, if she gets the same numbers over in Marvel may not be happy with that.
That's, yeah, but it would be a better book, so maybe it would get better numbers, because that's, I mean, other than the covers, I'm not too happy with these different series that have come out from Dynamite. But
yeah,
that's just me.
Yeah, I know that's the whole thing. I mean, I haven't looked at the Star Wars numbers to see if they got better when they moved over to Marvel, or whether they're the same as the Dark Horse numbers.
Oh, I'm guessing that they've sold pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. So then I went back to the artist alley, and I was walking around, and I just kept on like glancing at the different tables. Now, it's funny because, like, you know how L.A. Rabbit always talks about the different small press books that he finds.
Oh, yeah.
So
you can't walk down an aisle with L.A. Rabbit. He's like, you turn around and he's listening to this guy's pitch and that guy's pitch.
Right. So there was this woman who, she looked like she was in her 20s or 30s, and she was selling a lot of stuff that looked like it was very cartoony. And there were these two paperbacks that kind of caught my eye. And one of them was called Shooty Dark Knight. Shooty with an I. And the other one was called Shooty Watchman. Okay? And I was like, what are these? And she goes, open it up, look around. So I opened it up and I looked, and it was the same story as Watchmen, or the same story as Dark Knight Returns, and different panel layouts, different artists, obviously, different artwork. Some of the pages were just stick figures. But, you know, like it was the same story, and sometimes the same dialogue, sometimes it was different dialogue. And I was like, what? No, what is this? And she said, well, this is just a project that her art school had done, where a group of artists would get together and they'd have to recreate the graphic novel the way they would draw it. Obviously not the same talent as Frank Miller and Klaus Janson, but and they had to make sure they captured the energy of the book. That's the whole thing, because she said it was mainly people who worked on the project that knew the story, that bought the story and read the story and enjoyed the story, that could work on that project. Like, if you never read Watchmen before, you couldn't work on their Watchmen book, because you wouldn't have that energy, okay? So it was kind of funny, and I bought like one of the Dark Knight issues, and then I walked 2 aisles down, and Klaus Janson was there. So I showed him the book, and he's like, he was laughing. He thought it was funny, a good idea, and he was like, I'm going to go over to her table and buy a couple copies of this.
That's funny.
She had other books there that were indie-level books that had very cartoony, and they were more like slice-of-life graphic novels.
Yeah, but yeah, that's not going to get you sued by Klaus Janson. This will.
Well, he didn't mind it. He was like, whatever the market will bear, that's fine. I guess he doesn't see any patent infringement about it. So that was funny.
He didn't feel threatened, you mean?
No. No. At first he said, oh, is she selling millions? And I said, I don't think so. I went by Tom King's table, and he had a line out the door. So,
crazy, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, I went over to, I wasn't on the line. I was like to the side of the line, and I just waved to him, and I said, hi, Tom. And at first I didn't think he recognized me, but because I've talked to him when nobody was at his table. But he acknowledged me, but he didn't want the other people to think that I was cutting in line.
Sure, yeah, of course.
The funny thing is when I got, like you talk about crowds at New York, like I said, when I first got there at 10 o'clock and roamed around, you were able to walk around in Artist Alley and there was no problems. Then when I went to the panel and then came out of the panel, it was around 1:30, and then that's when everybody was all around Artist Alley.
That's when you close the door and go back into the panel.
Yeah, I almost wish there was another panel that I could go back in.
Yeah, right.
Because I really had to like avoid all the people with swords and everything else.
Sure.
You know, that were walking around. There were a lot of creative costumes and a lot of interesting things that were going on at that point. But it was too crowded, and next thing you know, it's 3 o'clock, and I had to leave. So
it sounds like you had some good encounters, though, in the short time that you were there, and got to get a feel of it, and got to feel a bit of the crowdedness that makes you confident in your decision to not have gone again a different day, too. You know,
right. I mean, we'll see next year what I decide to do and which day I decide to go on. It is getting, you know, it does get harder and harder to go to these things.
Yeah.
I mean, with my job, I cannot take Friday off and go Friday like some people do, because I'm always that week and the week after, which is now, I'm always busy.
It's tough to be a grown up.
I know.
And still read comics and enjoy this stuff.
I know. Brings me back to my days when I doing the 70s and the early 80s, when I used to be able to go to those cons, and I used to take the bus into the city. And the funny thing is, like, the first time I went, a lot of the dealers didn't have bags to give you. So you'd be holding these comics, and then you'd have to look around the garbage to see if you could put them in a box or something to bring them home. Now, the second day that I went back in the 70s, I actually found an empty box and I brought the empty box with me to the con, and I filled that box.
You remember when it was? It was not too long ago, after maybe the direct market, I want to say, but they started coming out with the little brown bags, right? That you could get that were like, they were a little bigger than comics, so you could have a little stack in there. It didn't come up much higher than the top of your comics, though. But it was like, man, when they came out those smaller brown bags, that was really something special. Because otherwise, like you said, you're walking around with a bunch of floppies flopping around.
yeah, and I was very afraid that that if I went to another dealer and I had the comics, he would start saying, "Oh, you stole those from my table," you know.
So, right, sure.
So you know, and I used to look for titles that lots of times these dealers wouldn't bring with them, because I was collecting different series that that weren't the mainstream popular series. I was collecting Metal Men and Jonah Hex and Challengers and different stuff like that. That they had them at the store, but they wouldn't bring them to the conventions because they didn't think that anybody was going to be asking for them, which is kind of strange. But I mean, there were some books that they would have that I would want. I mean, if you missed buying something at the newsstand and the book was a hot book, they used to jack it up a quarter or 30 cents above the cover price, which I used to hate because it was just out a month ago. And
well, do you remember the market dynamic of the 70s and into the mid 80s, at least, where issue number one would be pressed at a higher volume than issue number two because they weren't sure whether the title was going to be a hit or not? So the issue number twos of a lot of titles would be the one that was jacked up in price and hard to get as the back issue, because it wasn't until then that they got the numbers and they started, you know, upping the production again to whatever it needed to be for issue three or beyond.
Right. But I guess I didn't realize that when I was collecting during the 70s. You know, the thing that I always hated is when you're going and you miss Swamp Thing number 9, and then you go and then when you go to the con to pick that up, it was like a dollar as opposed to 60 cents, you know.
Well, I was 5 in 1975, so I wasn't buying any back issues other than things that relatives gave to me. I was just buying things off of the racks up until 1980, when my parents bought our first house, and on the third day we had a huge house fire and I lost all my comics basically. And it was then that I got into the understanding and of the taking care of the comics and understanding their quote unquote value, that I needed to figure out what comics I wanted to replace. I had a big collection, but I had a little chunk of money from the insurance or that my parents allotted to me to say, hey, this is what you can replace your comics. And I went to a couple of hotel banquet room type cons that were in the area in the early 80s and was able to decide what things I wanted to buy back and what things I didn't. And that was fun. That was my first getting to really, you know, to be like in 1982 or whatever as a 11 or 12 year old and be given okay, you have $125 to spend at this con to replace your comics. And it was like, this is, you know, I'm getting, it was pretty cool to start doing the wheeling and dealing and trying to buy stuff to replace what you had lost. But that's where I kind of got into the little mini con and the buying of back issues. And by then the direct market had gotten its foothold and there were a couple of LCSs in the area. And then I got into those back issues too. But that was really the catalyst for me, was that fire and having to replace the stuff that I had just bought off the racks.
Yeah. That is a funny way of getting into it, because I never would buy back issues through the mail. When I was collecting, I would only buy them at the con, and because that way I would get to see what I was buying, and if I didn't like that dealer's price, then I would go to the next dealer and see what he was having. And to me, it was the hunt to getting all those issues and everything. You know, this was in the 70s, so a big deal comic, a big expensive comic to me was like $3 or $5 or $7. And that's the most I would pay back then. I mean, obviously, there were the wall books that were standing up. And the funny thing is I never even asked to see those or to look at those, because they were either a series that I wasn't collecting, or I wasn't really interested, or I kind of knew, I guess, in my head that it would probably be so high priced that I wouldn't try to go buy it.
Yeah, yeah. I turned down time after time buying Hulk 181 or whatever it was, the first Wolverine, because it was $13, you know? I just didn't want to drop that much on the one issue. Right. What a fool am I? But, you know, isn't it funny now when you go back and you're saying you didn't buy order through the mail back issues and stuff. But when you go back now to those comics from the early 80s that had those Mile High ads and stuff in it, isn't it amazing to see the prices they had for some of that stuff? And it was Mile High, so you know it was already inflated prices too, right? And you're looking at it like, if only, my gosh.
Well, I had the one time I did try to buy through the mail was Robert Bell. I don't know if you've seen his ads in the 70s. Yeah, yeah. So he was the one. He used to sell this little book that was supposed to be a checklist.
Yeah,
that you would buy, and then also he used to have the catalog. So when I was a kid doing the 70s, he sent me the checklist. I think I must have ordered it, and I foolishly thought that I could order back issues that way through the checklist. Mm. And then I sent him like $5, and I sent, you know, I went this issue of Avengers, that issue of Avengers, you know. And then obviously I got this nice letter back saying,
That's not how this works.
Yeah. Right. Because I foolishly thought when I was a kid that I'd have to only pay cover price for these issues that were back issues. And then he explained, no. You're going to be paying more than cover price. So they only gave me like a couple of the issues that I asked for. And then they gave me back some of the money that I, you know, to cover
it. That's funny.
And it was funny because that was back in the days where you would tape coins to an index card, or you would have dollar bills in an envelope and mail it to people.
And Gary, you'd have to wait 6 to 8 weeks for, you know what I mean? That was allotted time for a reply. Yeah. Though that was tough to wait your 6 to 8 weeks for checking the mailbox, and then you never know,
right.
You know?
Right. You might even have to wait 3 months. So these kids who are like into Amazon Prime, where they expect their packages the next day, that amazes me. So, but that, you know, and then that it is funny, like how it's evolved to be such a market where I met somebody at the post office the other day. And he's got comics from the 60s and the 70s and maybe early 80s that he wants me to help him sell.
Oi.
I haven't gone to see the condition of them yet, but I had to, and then I had to explain to him that condition matters. Because you know how these people are, they go up and they Google a certain comic and then they see it selling for $100.
Yeah.
And they think they're going to get $100 for it already.
It's
just
like baseball cards, tell them.
Right.
Everybody understands baseball cards.
So, you know, I may, you know, meet with him and see what he has and everything. He sent me this big Excel file with listings and everything. And some of the things that he has, I don't think he knows what it is. You know, like he said he went to a store. He went to a store in Queens and he bought like a bunch of comics with him. And he has the Death of Gwen Stacy. And that dealer wants to buy that from him. And the dealer wants to buy like about 70 other comics for him, but like the guy wouldn't buy a whole bunch of other comics. And he gave me the list of the comics that the dealer wouldn't buy from him, and one of them was Amazing Spider-Man 129. And I was like, you mean to tell me? And I didn't talk to him again, and I said to myself, this guy's balking at Amazing Spider-Man 129, but yet he buys Gwen Stacy.
Well, you gotta know, if you're gonna sell to a dealer or a retailer, you need to sell it at a price that he can sell it and make money on. Whereas, if you're selling to a buyer, a fan, you can sell it closer to that price that the retailer would sell it for.
Yeah, that's what I was explaining to him. You know, and also he keeps on thinking that he should go and get them encased. And I tried to tell him that you're going to be spending money to do that, and I don't know if you really want to spend money to do that. And he keeps on thinking, oh, well, won't I get more money when I do that? And I was like, yes, but maybe you don't want to sell to those type of people that are just going to flip it. And he's like,
the whole market has become so evolved, hasn't it, Gary?
Yeah, I know. If I was him, I'd rather sell to people who are actually, you know, collectors, and they may read the comic, or they may want to keep it in the bag and board and just have it, you know, complete their run. You know, maybe they won't want to open up that issue. They'll just open up on Marvel Unlimited, you know. So that's the type of people that I deal with most of the time when I sell comics.
It all seems like too much work, Gary. As someone who's never sold anything in his life, except for my services.
It all seems like
too much of a hassle, and I guess that's why I'm sitting in a bunker.
I haven't started yet.
That's why I'm sitting in a bunker full of all this stuff around me. Oh, well.
So I'm going to probably meet with him next week and see what he has and go from there. I knew I couldn't buy them from him, and when I started talking to him, I said, I cannot buy these from you because I wouldn't be able to give you the price that you would want for them. You know, so, but, I mean, I have met people who didn't know what they had and were perfectly happy with, you know, whatever I could give them because they didn't really care.
Yeah.
They just wanted to, you know, like this.
You're trying to do right by this guy. I get it though.
Right. But this guy obviously knows what he wants. He thinks he can put his two sons through college, you know, with this money.
Oh, we all remember people like that. We all knew people like that in the 90s.
So.
All right, Gary. Thanks for coming on and sharing your con adventures. I got to have you on sometime really soon to do some recent reads. All right?
Yeah. Tell me what's different comics that you're going to have that you've been reading, and then I'll have to catch up with you, I guess.
We could do a round table. You bring some to the table, I'll bring some to the table, and we'll share, just like we were sitting against the tree in the park.
All right, good.
And how about that? Gary and I talked so long about New York that Andrew is now back from his trip. Didn't waste any time getting back on the con floor. Andrew, where have you been? What have you done since you've come out of the bush?
I'm back in country. Thanks for bringing me home. It's a long flight. I'm not going to lie to you. It's a couple of planes, a couple of sitting around. But I had to get back because it's the 8th annual. I don't know what we're going to call the show. It's technically now the Los Angeles Comic-Con, but it started as Kamikaze. For a while, it was Stan Lee's Comic-Con. Elvira was involved for a short period of time. But this is the one that's in downtown Los Angeles that happens over the Halloween period. Now, because Halloween, when it falls on, as it does in this year, midweek, they pick a weekend either before or after, in this case before. It's a 3-day show. I have the advantage of working in downtown LA, so I'm able to attend the Friday day, which is all I did this year. I used to go more, but the show has reached the size where Saturdays are frightening.
Huh.
And if I had a bigger, and a lot of my regular crew kind of bail on this show, not that it's a terrible show, it's just downtown LA is a terrible traffic location. For those of you not in the area, it's just due to the logistics of the freeways, they all kind of go through downtown. So, and on the Sunday of the con, it was traffic again, they're calling it, because all 5 major sports teams franchises are playing: soccer, football, basketball, baseball, and hockey, all in town today. Now, they obviously don't play at the same venue, but they're not so far apart that made, and there was a half marathon this morning in downtown too, so.
Jeez.
LA's rough at the best of times, but this was a we're not leaving the house on that Sunday. So,
how was Friday, Andrew?
Yeah, Friday was awesome. What I like about the show is it really is a mix. So in some years it's more comic heavy, and this year was a little bit more comic heavy. One of the things I don't like about the show, they're really poor about updating who's coming and who's not. So they'll have a bunch of names of people that are supposed to show up and they don't. And then for this year, Tim Seeley wasn't advertised. Oh. And there he was. So I went and actually, serendipitously, I hadn't gotten a sketch in a while, so I got him to give me a sketch. I figured, well, he doesn't have a long list because no one knew he was going to be here.
Right.
And he's a quality artist who I've appreciated. He did that Heroes for Hire book we talked about.
Yeah.
Going on maybe 4 years ago, something like that, with Misty Knight. And he had some pages at Cadence of Misty Knight that I would looked at long and hard. So I got him to do me a Misty Knight sketch.
Oh, cool.
And I tweeted that out for those of you interested in following me on Twitter at LA_rabbit1. With a one-day show, I mean, it's a three-day show, but from my perspective, one day, I don't really do panels or anything.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a good amount of time to walk the floor. I happened to run into my friend Sean from Parks and Cons, who everyone should know. They're like the ultimate. He and Carmel cover like every show. Plus, they love Halloween. So they do all kinds of haunts, I guess they call them, or mazes. So every night, if you follow their Twitter, you'll see two to three of these. And Halloween is just blown up. I don't know what it's like where you're at. But people turn their houses into little, like, Universal Studios horror things where they'll put in their garage, like, this little maze or these creepy things, and they do it up. And so they'll go to, like, for the, you know, starting in September through November, they'll go to, like, 60 different of these things. And plus there's the big ones like Universal and
You guys are just compensating for not having any change in the seasons out there with all this overdoing it on the holidays business.
I want to make it perfectly clear. I am not a Halloween guy.
No.
I liked it when I was a kid. I loved candy. All still right. do. But I think I've aged out of trick-or-treating. I mean, I haven't tried in a few years.
I should hope so.
But I don't... I'm not that into getting dressed up. So I don't really feel like buying
What about watching Young Frankenstein? And watching some, getting into the Universal Monster stuff, making it a point to read some horror comics and just enjoying some of the darker side of the pop culture world. I think that's fun.
Those parts I like, but the idea that I'm going to decorate up my place and buy expensive outfits and put on a lot of makeup and all that sort of stuff is not really something that's going to happen. Look, if I don't do that for the comic book shows, I'm not going to do it for Halloween. But there were lots of talent, so I bought a bunch of indie books, of course. I mean, it's who are you talking to? But I ran into Sean, like I said, walked a lot of the floor with him, caught up with him. But they had to go to another, like, three haunt things that night. So we just were only able to spend 45 minutes. Then I just walked the floor, talked to we're his friend. I don't know that he's a friend of the show, but Steve Lieber. Always fun catching up with him. I think his Superior Foes book has endeared him to Marvel Noise's still beating heart.
Absolutely.
They also had some of the Chris Burnham, who are those guys on the backside. So, you know, some recognizable names. I believe this weekend Scotty Young and Greg Capullo were due to show up. Cool. I did not see them. But they could be Saturday, Sunday. I don't, like I said, I never know with their, 1 year Bendis was supposed to come and he didn't, but they always have, they had a table for Rob Liefeld. You know, a lot of the people you'd expect to see. But Fridays, you know, it's always a crapshoot on the bigger names sometimes don't bother rolling in, which is fine with me.
Yeah. That's the trade-off for, you know, there's more elbow room, but everybody might not be there yet.
Oh, and so much more elbow room. I was following Sean's tweets from Saturday and Sunday, and it was just like, I made the right decision. I don't care what was there. It was, you know, you look at those crowd shots, and you're like, yeah, You can't really make it to. You can make it through the aisle, but you sort of have to do that shuffle zombie step to get through.
Yep.
Yeah, Saturdays are not for us faint of heart. But the interesting thing about LA Comic Con, Kamikaze, formerly Stan, whatever it is, they put the main stage on the exhibit floor, which is terrible for the vendors sitting right around them.
Right.
Like our friend ran into Darren from Sit Comics. He showed me some new pages, and he's bringing on some interesting people for the new books, but he didn't have any of the new print volumes yet.
Nice.
But he had his little iPad and was showing me some stuff. But I felt so bad because he was facing it, and it can just be kind of loud, especially for the filler stuff. It's not so bad when they have like the, you know, they had like the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., two of the actors come up and that type of thing. It's more the filler when it's like fashion show. So they'll play music. They also had like a geek-themed improv troupe. So there's a lot of intro music and stuff like that. And that can be a little overwhelming.
Yeah.
Plus the wrestling rink was there, although I don't think they were using it. They had one of the new lady wrestling organizations posing. And I took a picture of the ring, and they're like, come on up for a photo op. And I was like, I'm good down here. Thank you very much.
I was going to say, this is going to be like an Andy Kaufman wrestling bit in about 2 minutes. Step into like, the ring. Just raise. Yeah, all right. Exactly. Boom.
I was like, there is no that sort of radical difference in how good someone looks versus how good look I look is not meant for visual things. They also do a big Hot Topic Funko Pop exclusives. So the lines for those are always bananas. But I stood in line for 20 minutes to spin the wheel for a free gift. Because after I walked the floor, I was like, oh, I got a little bit of time waiting for my sketch to get finished. So I'm like, let's just do some silly floor things. The other nice thing about Friday is there's almost no autographs. So they literally had like 45, I'd say, spots for autograph, you know, the stanchions kind of, and all that's empty. Because the show is a big pop. While they have those comic names, they also do a lot of reunion-type stuff.
Okay. Well, it is L.A. You might as well take advantage of what you have around you personnel-wise, you know? Why ignore that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's not just Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and CW shows, but a lot of... I don't really follow that stuff, but The 100, I think, is a show.
Okay.
Something like that on net. I don't even know where it is, but that sort of pop culture geek, but not comic book related stuff. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge draw.
What about like vendors and comics and like old, like they have like good dollar bins and things or.
I feel like I may be out of touch with comic book pricing, but I think the show was bad. I saw ROM number one at one booth for $40 and another for $60.
Wow. Really?
That was Raw. I saw a ASM Raw. Number one. A graded Amazing Spider-Man number one graded as a one. And that was over $3,000.
Oh my gosh.
Huh. And maybe those are the, I don't, but you see that in like, or maybe he's the guy where you buy a bunch. Most of those guys, I know you can talk them down, but I feel like who am I to, like, over $3,000 for a one? I
mean, well, a one is still fair, I think, and a point .5 is poor. So,
I mean, why I asked about it is I almost never see ones. It's really rare to see, because most people don't even bring that sort of a low grade. Usually you won't see more than like a 2.5 or a 3. So I had to ask the guy. He also did have some beautiful Golden Age Wonder Woman. But again, when the asking price is $500-$600 an issue, I don't even feel like, what if I talk him down 50%? It's still...
Right.
And I just kind of want one as a reader copy, not... So, like I said, that may be the actual prices of comics, but now's a good time, Steve, to drop all that pristine new mint Golden Age books you have.
Yeah, right.
That you've been sitting on, you know, your first appearance of Batman, your
maybe,
Superman number.
maybe at least ROM number one from the sound of it.
Yeah, I had to tweet Aaron Myers about the ROMs because I'm like, man, like 40, 60. I mean, remember when you could buy like the whole brick except for the X-Men issues?
Well, back in the day, that was still at the time, and I know I was talking about this, I believe, with Gary just a little while ago, is that for a while in the, at least the late 70s and early 80s when I was doing most of my comic buying, the second issue was often severely underprinted because you weren't sure whether the first issue was going to be a hit or not. So they, like, by the time you got the sales figures back, it was already time to choose how much you were going to print for issue number 3 and 4, that kind of thing. So historically, for a while there, the issue 2s, if you didn't buy it off the stand when it was on sale that month, was really hard to find as back issues. And you could get the number 1s of things, but that number 2 was like a limited print run all the time. So, like, I remember ROM number 2 was hard to get. Marvel Fanfare number 2 was hard to get. G.I. Joe number 2 was hard. Like, all these ones were ridiculously high priced as a back issue almost immediately out of the chute because of their lower print runs. And it's funny that, you know, they get so much more with the world of pre-ordering. They don't have to worry about that anymore.
No,
books fail before they even hit the stands now, Andrew.
Well, the other thing I remember when we were kids is you would get runs, but they would miss like the 3 crossover with the X-Men. Like, those are the only ones that had value. So it would be ROM 1 through 75, except for like issue 4, whatever that Nightcrawler, that was, because that was worth like all the rest of the ones combined practically. So it always made me laugh how now those, I think, relative haven't held their value at all. And it's just first appearances of things and number ones. But for a while, always those crossover issues, because dang it, a popular character appeared in this turkey. But so, I did buy some indie books, which I need to revive Indie Comic Book Noise so I can give everyone pleasant chatter about all those. But I will be back for the 9th year, assuming it doesn't have a new name or whatever. And I fully recommend people consider the Friday option. I know it's expensive for time off or whatever, but I just feel it's so much better on your psyche not to be pressed in.
Andrew,
cheek to jowl.
Don't give away our con secrets. All right, that's it for this episode of Marvel Noise. Sorry again for the wait, but I've been trying to batten down the hatches for winter, which came a little early this year in the upstate New York area. And the more moving parts that I am dealing with, the more that my vestibular pathology manifests and keeps me from being able to be productive in between. But it's winter here, holiday season. Looking forward to buckling down, reading a lot of comics, and telling you all about it. I hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving. Next episode will be the rousing conclusion to our multi-year coverage of the original Thunderbolt series. And we'll also be taking a good solid look at the recent Spider-Man Spider-Geddon event. So until the con crud takes us all down for good, make mine Marvel. Later.
Farm, we are with the Max Yazgurt.